Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries, and part two of our interview with Louis Gallo and the Ulysses S. Grant Memoirs. Louis was chased out by a tornado at the end of our part one, and this is the continuation, part two, of Ulysses S. Grant, His Memoirs Revealed, an interview with Louis Gallo. Describe Grant's life after he left the White House. What were some of the milestones and highlights of his life after he left?
Yeah, certainly. So his life after the presidency was kind of unprecedented at the time. He was actually the first president, either sitting or, you know, former president, to travel the world. After he left the White House, Rutherford B. Hayes is elected to the presidency. Grant decides that him and his wife and actually his son are going to go on just a little vacation of sorts. And that's how, that was the plan originally, was just to go on a vacation, travel the world, see as many sites as they possibly could. Well, that trip morphed into a type of diplomatic world tour, which was the first of its kind, like I said, for any president. You know, he starts out, like I said, it's essentially as soon as he leaves the White House, he starts on this tour. They leave the East Coast, and they arrive in Great Britain, and he's welcome. He's well received when he reaches Britain. The royal family welcomes him, and he also is accepted by just the common folk, because they kind of see Grant as someone they can look up to, because he had a humble beginnings, but was able to reach, you know, the peak, right? He obtained the highest office in the country. And so there was something endearing about that to the British people. And so he gave a few speeches to the common folk. But then he met with the Queen, which was really interesting. There are some good accounts of that encounter. You have his wife, Julia, had her own memoirs that she wrote. And she talks about that visit, which was interesting. The Queen liked him. You know, he's a good guy to her. She thought he was a little rough around the edges, as expected, you know, because he's really a rough and rugged Westerner at the time. So I can understand why she saw that in him. But also while he was there, he got to visit with his daughter, Nellie, who had married an Englishman and had moved over there. And so that was a really big event for them. So after he meets with the Queen, they go to France. Grant wasn't a big fan of Paris. He said that he was not impressed, which I can understand, knowing who Grant was.
Everybody trying to kiss him on both cheeks.
Yeah, that wasn't his style, I don't think. But after that, he keeps going back and forth between Britain and France, and then he travels to Italy. He actually meets with the Pope, which is really interesting. Then after that, or I think it was soon after, or it might have been before, but he met with Bismarck, which the German Chancellor.
Bismarck,
yeah. He was very impressed with Bismarck.
And what year was this?
So this would have been, like I said, right after his presidency. So I believe the tour was from, this would have been 78 to 80. I believe.
And what was brewing in politics in Europe and in America, and how important was this tour? How did it become a diplomatic tour?
You know, when Grant leaves the presidency, it's kind of the end of Reconstruction for America. Hayes comes in, and all these other Southern politicians kind of get into office, and it kind of derails Grant's Reconstruction policies. And so it's a big shift for America. And, you know, and with what's going on in Europe, you know, you have all of these big royal families who are still in charge. And you have Bismarck, who's taken over control over in Germany. Grant really was, like I said, it was the first time a president had ever had the chance to do this. And so this was kind of this was the first impression of sorts for him and for not just for Americans, but for the government, for the country itself, right? He's kind of introducing America to the rest of the world, essentially, is what's happening. And it didn't seem like it was going to be that important at first, it definitely morphs into something way bigger than what it was. And so when he's meeting with Bismarck, you know, they're both military men. And so immediately they start talking about, you know, the war. The Civil War, because Bismarck was very interested in the Civil War. And Grant, you know, they had a really good discussion. Bismarck he tried to say that, oh yeah, you were trying to preserve your country. We understand that. And he goes, yes, well, I was trying to preserve the country, but also it was about ending slavery. So he was kind of reinforcing that idea. So it's just it's really interesting to read the accounts of their meeting, because what I remember of it is, Grant, he's invited. And so he shows up to Bismarck's place. He just walks up to the door and knocks on it. And they greet him, and they're like, what are you doing? He's like, oh, I'm here to see Bismarck. And they're, oh, okay. because he's not full of pomp. He's not very formal kind of guy. And so it's just kind of informal little meeting. And so those two really hit it off, which is really interesting to me. And then from there, he keeps traveling. He actually goes to Egypt. He sees some of the ruins in Egypt. And we have some really cool pictures in our collection about Grant and while he's in Egypt. You can see he's enjoyed it, but you could tell the sun was just beating down on him because he's got his head covered. He's kind of slouched over, and he's kind of he has the look of like, get me out of this place, and from there he travels into Asia. He sees the Holy Land, and at that point, actually, I believe his eldest son Fred joins them, and so it's him, his wife, his son Jesse, and his eldest son Fred.
So from and Egypt to the Holy Land.
Yeah, or at least when he gets into Asia, Fred's with him. And at that point, Grant actually started keeping like a little journal of sorts. And we have it. It's published in the papers of Ulysses S. Grant, which is, the 32 volumes that the Grant Association published over a 40-year span. But we added the transcription and some scholarly notes surrounding that journal. So it's a really interesting little account from Grant, personal account from Grant.
A quick segue. How would people find that right now? What would you need to search?
Of course. So luckily, we actually have every volume digitized, and it's on our website. And you can access it for free. Anybody can access it. You just go, go to Google, type in Ulysses S. Grant Presidential Library, click on our website. You'll find, I think there's a little tab for researchers, and then you click on collections, and then you'll find it through there. And you can... Every page of the published volumes is accessible.
Okay, and not to interrupt you.
Yeah, go ahead.
So he's with family now.
Yes.
Now, you said they did the Middle East and they did Jerusalem.
Yes.
And then, was it then to Asia?
Yes, from there.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if it's, a direct route, but he's kind of all over the place.
Now Asia, 1878 to 1880, that's pretty much unvisited. Am I correct in saying that? We hadn't had anybody there.
Right. Well, I mean, as a president, presidents, no, right? So he's kind of jumping all over the place. I think he goes back to Italy at one point, and then, he's all over the place. It's a 2-year trip, and so he's taking full advantage of everything that he can see, and like I said, that journal that he has, that he kept, was really, it's really detailed and really interesting. He gets some really good insights into what he saw and to what he liked and what he thought was kind of dull. I don't think he was too impressed with the Great Wall, if I remember correctly. There was something in Asia he wasn't thrilled about. But it just, again, it's really interesting. He goes through India into China, and then actually when he's in Asia, it gets really interesting. He does some he handles some talks between the Chinese and the Japanese. There's this dispute over the Ryukyu Islands, I believe that's how you say it. The China Islands. I don't want to get this wrong. I want to say maybe Okinawa is a part of that island chain.
I'm not sure.
But you get the general area.
Yes.
But he actually, like I said, he mediated the talks between the two countries to try to settle the dispute over the island, which, again, this is unprecedented for the time and even for today for a president to be doing this. Unfortunately, I don't. The talks kind of fell through afterwards, after he left and everything. But still, the significance of an American president going and doing some diplomacy overseas in the 1870s is really, really important, I think.
Yeah, they must have been very interested to know, to get the viewpoint from someone who had been president of the United States, which was pretty much looked at as an upstart.
Yes.
And what is this new system of a democratic republic you're working with? How's that working out for you?
Yeah. Yeah, most certainly. The Japanese especially, they really admired Grant. And Grant was impressed with Japan. I think part of the reason why he was impressed with Japan was because it had some Western influence. There was a lot of industry there. In Grant's eyes, they were quote unquote civilized, you know. And so I think there was a lot of respect between Grant and between the Japanese. And you can still see it today. There's a huge interest in Ulysses S. Grant in Japan. We get reference questions from people in Japan. We actually had a researcher who came from Japan to do research here. So it's really interesting. And there are some interesting, there are even some biographies on Grant written in Japanese. And a lot of them are kind of, I would definitely call them fictitious. They're kind of glorified stuff, but it's just really intriguing to read their take on who Grant was and how they perceived him, you know. But from there, you know, after 2 years, being on the trip for 2 years, Grant then returns back to America. They go across the Pacific Ocean. They arrive in San Francisco, again, to great fanfare. Grant, you know, he actually, had spent time on the West Coast, and so he was familiar with that place. And then they traveled to the continental United States. They went to Nevada and places like that. They went down into a mine, a silver mine, I believe, at one point too. And Julia went with him, which was a really funny story because, you know, they get to it and Grant says, "Oh, no, I don't think she wants to go down there with us." And Julia says, no, I'm going down in that mine with you." And we have this really cool picture of her and him after they came out of the mine. And she's, you know, she's holding her little lantern and she's in this big, heavy, dirty coat. And she doesn't look too thrilled. But knowing Julia, I can understand why she was adamant about going down, because she didn't want to be left out. She was a very strong-minded woman, that's for sure. So after that, he comes back. They're done with the tour. They kind of settle down at that point, you know, because, you know, going on a world tour for 2 years in the 1870s is pretty exhausting.
It sounds like that would be very exhausting.
Yeah.
And did they settle in upstate New York? Was that where they went?
Yeah, I believe at that point they're living in New York City after that. And, you know, and so Grant himself, you know, he's trying to settle down, but he's also still trying to make a living. And so he invests his money. I think he invests in some silver mines, maybe in some railroad companies, things like that. And then at that point, his son, Buck, actually started a firm with a man named Ferdinand Ward. So it was a business firm called Grant and Ward, right? Now, Ferdinand Ward at the time, he was considered, I think his nickname was the Young Napoleon of Finance. So he was well-respected. He made people a lot of money, right? He was trusted, but that was all a facade. He was actually a crook. He had essentially set up what we would consider a Ponzi scheme at the time. So basically he was using the same collateral for multiple loans. And
the same guy that went down, what was it, 7-8 years ago?
Bernie Madoff.
Yeah, Barry Madoff. Same
essentially,
type.
Right?
Yeah.
And so Grant and his son are completely unaware of this, and everything's fine, right? Everything works in that scheme as long as the investments are paying off. But once they stop paying off, then everything falls apart. Mm. And so in May of 1884, everything came crashing down.
Oh,
Grant and Ward went under, which actually caused a little bit of a panic on Wall Street. Grant had everything invested into this firm.
1873 was a depression, right? So happened in 1874, that would have just tanked it.
Well, this is 1884.
1884, okay, sorry.
Yeah, but still, it was enough to where he was completely bankrupt. I think he had maybe $80 to his name. And so this is a former president, right? So this is something this is a big deal. So Grant, you know, even though he's bankrupt, he has a lot of wealthy friends, and so they help him. I think one of the Vanderbilts gives him a loan to help him trying to keep his head above water. And so at that point, Grant really needs to find a way to get some sort of income for himself and for his family. And, you know, for the past, you know, probably during his presidency up until that point, he was there were multiple people coming to him asking if he would write his story about, you know, his life story. And he always dismissed it. He always said, oh, no, that I'm not a good writer. You know, they don't want to hear my story. It's been written about plenty. They don't want to hear me, right? Well, once he's bankrupt, he decides, well, maybe I should try to do this, right? And so he reaches out to Century Magazine. Century Magazine at the time, they were doing a series called the Battle of Leaders series. So essentially they would get veterans of the Civil War, you know, high commanders, to write a little article about their experience at a certain battle, and then they would publish it. And so Grant decided, well, maybe this is a way to get some money. And so he agreed to write four articles for about, I think, $500 a piece. So it's not much, but, you know, it's something. So he starts writing them. I think the first one he did was on the Battle of Shiloh. And he submits his draft to the editors. And they all look at it and they realize that this is not a very good article. It read like a battle report. It was very dry, no personal details, nothing, right? And so they selected one of the lower editors. They said, hey, why don't you go talk to him? See if you can kind of, you know, get him on the right track and see if you can find a way for him to kind of pump it up a little bit, you know. And the editor actually goes and speaks to him, and he says, tell me about the battle, right? It's just one-on-one. He says, tell me about the battle. And so Grant talks to him about this. And during the conversation, this editor realizes that Grant is a fantastic storyteller, right? He's been telling these stories for 20 years, right? And one-on-one conversations, he's great at it. And so the editor stops him. He says, "That what you just told me is fantastic. Write an article like that. Tell me your side, right? Tell me the personal details. We want to hear the personal side. Forget the casualty figures and the troop movements and order of battle. Give us your personal take on this stuff." And it was kind of a light bulb moment for Grant, right? He realizes, oh, so okay, so this is what they want to hear. And so he rewrites it, and it's fantastic from there, right? So during this is in the summer of 1884, he's writing these articles. Everything's going well until July. He's at Long Branch, New Jersey with his wife. And he picks up a peach and he takes a bite of this peach and he feels this immense, terrible pain in his throat. And, you know, he doesn't think anything of it. He thinks, maybe it was a bug in the fruit. Maybe he took a part of the pit and it scratched his throat. Didn't think anything of it, right? Julia tells him, well, you should go see the doctor. You should go see the doctor. And like a typical husband, he says, no, I'm fine. I'm fine. You know, stubborn man as he is. Well, over time, after a couple months, the pain doesn't go away and it starts to hurt worse. And so he finally goes and sees a doctor. And the doctor looks at it and he can't confirm that it's cancer, but they're pretty sure it's cancer. And so they send him to some other throat specialists, leading throat specialists at the time. But during this time, Grant he's moved past writing articles, and he's actually decided that maybe he should write his memoir. And so he starts writing his personal memoirs. Well, because he had a decent relationship with Century Magazine, he figured, well, maybe I can get a publishing deal through them. And so they offer him a terrible deal. It was a terrible contract. But during this process, Mark Twain hears about this. Now, Mark Twain is one of Grant's closest friends, believe it or not, it's a great friendship that, you know, that most people don't realize, you know, because they're essentially polar opposites, you know, on the surface, right? You think of Twain, who's like essentially the first humorist in America, right? He's a comedic genius, so he's very loose and funny. And then you have Grant, you know, the stoic, stone-faced general, right? So you wouldn't think they would be friends, but they were close friends. Grant thought Twain was one of the funniest people. And those little anecdotes are fantastic between those two. Twain actually wrote about it, his relationship with Grant in his own autobiography, which is really great to read. I highly recommend it. But anyway, so Twain hears about this deal that Century Magazine has given Grant. And so he goes and he sits down with Grant. And Grant has the contract, Century contract, in his hand. He's about to sign it. And Twain says, let me see that. And he looks at it and he goes, oh, this is terrible. This is something that a first-time author would get, a deal that a first-time author would get. He goes, forget that. He says, I have a publishing company, Charles L. Webster and Company, which is his, I think it's his cousin's, Charles L. Webster. He goes, I'll give you a much better deal, and you and your family will like what we have to offer. What we have to offer. And so Grant says, well, let me think about it. You know, because Grant, he doesn't want to, you know, he felt that Century did, you know, helped him out when he needed it. He didn't want to turn his back on him. But after looking at the Mark Twain offer, he realized, no, I've got to go with that one. And so he signs a deal with Mark Twain. And so for the next 7 months or so, because that was in December, I believe, November, December. For the next 7 months, Grant just goes at writing his memoirs. Every day of his life, he's writing, and at an incredible rate as well. Now, it's not just all from memory, right? He has people with him. He has access to the government records, and you know, because at the time they started to publish the official records of the War of the Rebellion. It hadn't been completed, but there were some volumes, I believe, and so he had access to those ones and the unpublished documents to, you know, kind of jog his memory and make sure he got all the details right. But during this time is when he realizes that he, in fact, has throat and mouth cancer, and it's advanced, and it's not looking good for him. And so he's dying while he's writing his memoirs. And so there are moments during early 1885 where they're afraid that he's going to die. You know, and the newspapers are covering every little detail that they possibly can. And so one headline you'll see, oh, he's on his deathbed. This is it for Grant. And then he makes it out of it, you know, coughs up some blood, just gets to writing again. And so he just kept writing. At this time, he's in New York City. But when the summer comes around, they decide that he needs to get out of the city. You know, you have the summer heat and all the heat from the city. He could barely breathe as it was. And so that's when they decided to go to Mount McGregor, New York, upstate, in the countryside. So, you know, fresh air, he could breathe and feel better while he's writing. And so he kept writing until July, I think it was either July 19th or July 20th is when he officially stopped writing his memoirs. And he said he did all he could do at that point. He actually dies a few days later. So it was really keeping him going. It's a really inspiring story when you think about it. It's really his last battle. That he fights, and knowing Grant, you know, he, like he said, once he started doing something, he did not stop, right, until it was done, and that was true with his writing of the memoirs. So he actually never saw it published because he passed away well before it could be put in print.
Now you've read probably every word of his memoirs, is that correct?
A couple times.
What do you think were the most moving moments in that he was writing about?
Yeah, so in my opinion, I think Grant is just a fantastic storyteller, and you can see that in his writings, in his memoirs. The way he details his early life is really interesting. His description of the Civil War obviously is fantastic, invaluable for historians and for, you know, anybody interested in studying Grant. But for me personally, let me back up here. We came out with an annotated edition of his personal memoirs in 2017. And so that's what I did when I was first hired to work here. The project that I started with was working on his memoirs. And so I worked on the project for 3 years. And in that time, you know, I'm getting to know him even more, right? Because you're reading his words and you're really going through and with a comb and trying to, you know, break it down and unpack everything that he's talking about. And so you start to really get to know the man and get to understand his story. But there's one point in the process I remember near the end where he was talking about the Overland campaign, and he was talking about the death of General Sedgwick, who was one of his close friends. The story goes Sedgwick was on his horse. You know, the Confederates are, you know, they can see them. They can see the Confederates, and his men tell him, you know, General, get down from the horse. They're going to shoot. You know, they'll see that you're a general, and they'll shoot you. And he says, they couldn't hit the broadside of an elephant. And as soon as he said that, he got shot and killed. And Grant's description of how that impacted him really affected me. I think just because I had been working on the project for so long at that point, that was the kind of moment where it kind of humanized everything for me. It's one thing to just read about, you know, casualty numbers and like I said, the order of battle and stuff. You're kind of numb to that stuff. But once you read detailed personal accounts like that, it really gets to you. That was the kind of moment for me where I realized, wow, this war was not, I mean, obviously war is terrible, but that one especially was just it was so brutal and tough for the men too. You know what I mean? And to read how that affected Grant was really tough. So in that, I gained an appreciation for what I was studying and how significant it is to us today and how significant it was to them then, you know? So that was kind of a big moment for me, I guess. But like I said, Grant was a fantastic storyteller. I don't think he gets enough credit for that. You know, you can read his military orders, and you know they're concise and they're clear and they're all that stuff. But when you read his personal accounts, you really get to understand. You can really get inside of his head and understand who he was.
How did he feel about Julia and his children? Were there any stories about that relationship with family that really stand out for you? That show Grant as the kind of man he was.
Yeah. So it's a great question. So with Julia in particular, I think the way he talks about her in the memoirs is really, it's really nice. So again, going back to his storytelling ability, the way he sets up his relationship with Julia is really impressive, I think. So, you know, in the memoirs, he talks about his early life from the beginning, his time at West Point, and then when he meets Julia. And he has this ability to set up a story. And so, you know, he introduces her, you know, and he's, oh yeah, I met this young woman and I got to know her, and you know, and then I go off to fight the Mexican-American War, and I'm writing back and forth with her, you know, yada yada yada. And then it gets to the point where he comes back from the war and then he marries her. And so he does a fantastic job at setting up that storyline, right? Now you can contrast that with someone like Sherman, for example. Sherman, who had his own he wrote his own memoirs. When Sherman talks about his wife in his memoirs, he doesn't introduce her until I think like chapter 4, and it's in passing. He's just like, at the start of chapter 4, he's like, yeah, then I got married. And so what? And he wanted to talk about who was at the wedding more than is that his actual wife. But so that's, you know, looking at the difference between the two, it's telling, right? It shows just how close Grant was with Julia and just how much he loved her. And that's what I've learned is that. And I didn't realize this when I first started working here, was just how much of a family man he actually was. He was very fond of his wife. I mean, you can see that in the early, in volume 1 of the papers of Ulysses S. Grant, we have his correspondence to her during the Mexican-American War. And it's just, they're the most romantic letters you could possibly think of. And again, that was so surprising to me, because in my head, I see Ulysses S. Grant, again, as this stoic, stern, stone-faced general, right? You don't think of him as a romantic type, a hopeless romantic, but he really was. And he loved his children, most certainly. You can see that in his letters to Julia when he's out on the West Coast, you know, because he's away from both Julia and his eldest son, Fred. And at that time, when he leaves, Julia has their second son. And so he didn't see his second son until he was 2 years old. And you can imagine, right, just how much that would affect you. But again, you can just see the relationship that they had together. And it was really, I don't know, it's just, again, it's just something that was just so surprising to me, to see how much affection he had. And you can see that too. I believe Jesse actually wrote his own little recollections of his father after, I think, in the 1900s. And so he details his relationship with his dad. And I think he mentioned something about how Grant never raised his voice to him. He's always caring and loving to him. And so, I mean, obviously he's not going to talk bad about his father, but it reveals a side of Grant that most people don't know about.
Tell us about the mysteries that surround Grant and his life.
Yeah. So I was thinking about this, because obviously this is the podcast is seems to me, is based
histories
on,
and mysteries.
Right, of course. So I was thinking about this. I think the biggest mystery to me would be, you know, broadly speaking, would be his early life, right? So before he became this national figure, this prominent Civil War general, he really was a nobody before the Civil War, right? I think I told you in the first part that he was struggling before the war. He was selling firewood on the streets. He was a nobody, and so the family didn't really keep records the way that they did after that, right? Because why would you, right? He's just, who is he? So there, I think the lack of correspondence and documentation of his early life is really a big mystery. So, like, I mentioned his time in the Mexican-American War, how in the first volume of the papers of Ulysses S. Grant, we have his side of the correspondence. We don't have Julia's side of the correspondence. And so that's a huge gap in the literature. So you have to really kind of guess what she was saying to him by reading his letters to her, right? So he'll say, oh, yeah, you said such and such and such and such. And you kind of have to guess, I don't know what he's talking about. So, you know, again, it's just a hole there.
What happened to those letters from Julia?
I don't believe he really talks about it too much.
Was that catch of letters ever found, I guess is what I'm asking.
I don't think so. No, I would say no.
So if they're sitting in a trunk somewhere, they'd be definitely worth some.
I would say
jingle,
so.
Right?
My guess, though, is that, he's fighting in the Mexican-American War at this time, and he's all over the place. He starts fighting in the north. And then he moves into Mexico City to fight under Winfield Scott. And so with all that movement going around, I just couldn't imagine him having the time or even the capability to maintain all those letters. But he does talk about something, and I pulled up this quote here, and I'm going to read it. It's kind of a long quote, so hang with me here. But I'm going to set it up for you. So after he graduates from West Point, he moves to St. Louis, and he's stationed at Jefferson Barracks, which is where he meets Julia. Well, during that time, he actually kept a journal while he was at West Point, or I'm sorry, at Jefferson Barracks. And he talks about this journal in his memoirs. And so I'm going to read you the quote and what he says. He says, I reviewed my West Point course of mathematics during the 7 months at Jefferson Barracks and read many valuable historical works, besides an occasional novel. To help my memory, I kept a book in which I would write up, from time to time, my recollections of all I had to read since last posting it. When the regiment was ordered away, I, being absent at the time, my effects were packed up by Lieutenant Hazlitt of the 4th Infantry and taken along. I never saw my journal after, nor did I ever keep another, except for a portion of the time while traveling abroad, which is that one I told you about. Often since, a fear has crossed my mind lest that book might turn up yet and fall into the hands of some malicious person who would publish it. I know its appearance would cause me as much heartburning as my time when I was, the stories of when I was a child. So there could be a journal out there that he kept during his time at Jefferson Barracks that we don't know about.
Whoa.
Because we don't have it here at the Grant Library, and we like to say that we have every known document related to Grant that ever existed, or that still exists, I should say. And so, to me, if that isn't a mystery, I'm not sure what is, that journal. And the way he talks about it, I can only imagine what he wrote.
Imagine that turning up at a flea market.
If it's at a flea market, you might get a good price. But if it's at an auction, I don't know if you're going to afford it. So that's a really big mystery, I think. I would love it if that thing was found. But who knows, if it'll ever be found. The last mystery, though, that I want to talk about real quick is William Jones. I think I might have talked about this on the first part. William Jones was a slave that Grant owned for a year. So when he married Julia's family, they were slave owners. And so during this period before the Civil War, Grant, as I said, Grant was struggling, and he was trying to make some sort of living through farming. And so his father-in-law, we think, either gave him William Jones or sold him to Grant. We're not really sure what happened, but either way, he acquired this man. And so for a year, him and William Jones and some other African-American slaves that I think he had hired, they might have been freedmen, I'm not really sure. The details are kind of blurry with the story. But him, William Jones, and these four other men actually did, they farmed together. They helped Grant with the farming process. And there are accounts that Grant actually works alongside them. And so he really gets to know these men, especially William Jones. Well, after a year, he gives Jones his freedom. Now, this is the mystery for historians, is why he gave Jones his freedom, right? He's at a time where he's struggling financially. So it wouldn't make sense for him to just free him, right? He could have sold him, right? He could have kept using him to make money somehow. But for some reason, he frees him. And we have the manumission document, where it's the legal document that he signed, I, Ulysses S. Grant, free, so and so and so and so. But he never gives a reason as to why he freed Jones.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
And so that's really, I think, a big mystery, is his motivation for freeing Jones.
To the casual listener, they would say, at that point, maybe he felt a revulsion towards slavery as a whole, and right. That was the reason he did.
Yeah, so from what I've studied, and we might have touched on this in the first part, from what I've studied, there was an evolution for Grant on his views on slavery. And, in his early life, he said he was never an abolitionist. But then as he creeped closer and closer to the Civil War, his views start to change. And I think, really, they change because of his father-in-law. There are accounts of discussions that he had with Frederick Dent about slavery. Frederick Dent is a colonel. Colonel in quotes, meaning he's a plantation owner who's very adamant about the institution of slavery. And Grant comes from an abolitionist family. And so he's having these back and forth discussions, and I think he starts to understand just how impactful slavery is on the country. And there's one letter once the war breaks out where Grant is writing to Frederick Dent, telling him that this war will be the doom of slavery. So this will be the end of slavery. And so he understood from the get-go just how impactful slavery was, not only on keeping the country. Getting rid of it now and keeping how it would keep the country together, but he understood I think he started to realize just how evil the institution was, because he was finally witnessing it, right? When he was a kid, he wasn't involved. He wasn't around slaves. He was in Ohio, so he might have seen the occasional runaway, but it didn't really impact him until he marries Julia. Then it's directly affecting him. I think that's when he starts to realize just how terrible of an institution it is.
Now, Grant and Lincoln were both Republican presidents, is that correct?
Yes.
And what was the situation politically from the time Grant entered office as a president until around 1900 between the two parties? Which parties were honestly trying to promote Reconstruction, and which party was trying to fight against it?
Yeah, so the Republicans were most certainly the party that was trying to maintain Reconstruction and trying to make sure, that obviously slavery would be done with and that there would be some sort of equality between the races. The Democrats were staunchly opposed to that. I don't think you see that shift until later, until the 1900s. But during the 1800s, the Republican Party really takes up the mantle of being the party of equality.
Well, throughout the 1900s, wasn't the South run by Democrats
Yes.
who were not in favor of integration?
Yeah. You don't really see a switch, a major switch, until later on in the 1900s. But yeah, for the most part, it's the Republican Party like you're saying, the Democrats are in control in the South, and they're really the Democratic Party is the one that kind of enforces those Jim Crow laws after Reconstruction ends. And there's debate on when Reconstruction officially ends, but
you know, yeah, right. I am still amazed today at how the Republicans picked up a reputation as being such racist, when actually throughout this whole time, from Lincoln to today, the Republicans have been fighting for equality for the blacks, including the Civil Rights Act of 1968, I believe it was, or when it was the Republicans who ended up passing that in Congress and in Senate.
So it's a tough conversation, just because the political parties in name are always the same, but their platforms most certainly shift. And that goes for both of them. You can still see that today. I mean, they're arguing. I heard Republicans today talk about how, you know, JFK was alive today, he'd be a Republican.
I've heard.
So
that.
It's really tough to nail down just what each party stands for over such a long period of time, just because there's so much shifting going on, right?
It is.
For example, you've got Teddy Roosevelt, who really kind of helps to get the progressive movement going.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But today, Republicans would not see themselves as "quote unquote" progressive. So it's a really tough.
Yeah.
It's a fluid thing that's occurring, and it's really tough to nail it down over such a long period of time.
Yeah, Teddy Roosevelt, an interesting guy. There's a lot of stories there.
Oh, talk about a character.
Tell us about Grant's tomb and the whole story surrounding that.
Yeah, I can give you some details about his tomb. So, when Grant passes away, let me back up. Before Grant passes away, there's a discussion on where he was going to be buried, right? He wanted to be buried at West Point initially, but the policy at the time forbid his wife from being buried alongside him. And so he decided to just leave it up to her as to where his body would be. And so the family actually chose Riverside Park in New York City. You know, they had lived there for a while, and they had a strong connection to the city, and so she felt that would be an appropriate place for him to be. Now, initially, he was interred in a small temporary tomb until a better one could be constructed. And so after years of deliberation and fundraising, his final tomb, which is a grand mausoleum in Riverside Park, was officially dedicated on what would have been his 75th birthday on April 27, 1897. And so it's a long and involved story on how that tomb finally came about, because there was competition over the design, there was a struggle to raise the money, some of the public opinions were against Grant being in New York City. Some people felt that he should have been buried in D.C., It was just a big ordeal. But like I said, eventually it ends up in Riverside Park in New York City. But perhaps the most interesting part of the story of his death, I think, was the funeral procession that they had in New York City. So it was a 7-mile-long funeral procession up Manhattan Island. It was one of the longest funeral processions in American history, and one of the largest. It's hard to really tell exactly how many people were there. My guess is probably 1 million people there if you put a number on it. But what's really interesting is that, you know, during this procession, people are taking all kinds of photographs, right? Because this is, you know, the hot new technology, and people want to capture this moment, right? Well, there was a company that decided to gather all of those photographs and to publish them into book form. And then sell that book, you know, to various businesses like hotels. And if you're waiting on a hotel room, you can thumb through the Grant's funeral procession book, which kind of sounds morbid to us a little bit, but you can imagine how popular that would be at the time. So they come up with this book, and some of them, most of them, are actually really big. They're large books. I'm talking like 3 feet by 2 feet, like a really big book, like on a stand. That's how big this book is, right? Well, the people who took the photographs felt like they got the wrong end of the deal. And so they actually sued the company. And the company was never able to sell the book. But what's really neat is here at the Grant Library, we actually have one of the four remaining copies of this book. We have it on display. And it's fantastic. It, like I said, the stand itself, it just screams Gilded Age. It's this, you know, just an amazing look, artifact. And it's huge. Now, we don't like to touch it. We actually have it encased because, you know, it's so big and the binding's falling apart and everything. But what we actually did is we digitized every photograph that we could in the book. And we put it on an interactive next to the book in the gallery. And so as a visitor comes through, they can actually, quote unquote, page through the book without having to actually touch the book. And you can see all the images that are inside. Probably the most interesting image to me is there's this one shot of the procession, you know, coming up Manhattan, and you can see the New York City skyline. And it looks, it's not, it's unrecognizable to us, right? Because, you know, we think New York City, you see big skyscrapers, everything. I think the highest point in that photograph is a church steeple, just to give you an idea. And so just to see the development over, you know, that time period is really incredible. But that's a really, really neat artifact that we like to talk about and we like to have, like I said, on display because it's so rare.
I'd like you to remind our listeners with your name and what your responsibility is, how you have become connected with Grant's memoirs and what you do on a daily basis.
Yeah, sir. So my name is Louis Gallo. I am a documentary editor and / historian here at the Ulysses S. Grant Presidential Library. I got here because my training is specifically in documentary editing. And so as a documentary editor, I contextualize documents for readers. I'm not to be confused with filmmaking. I don't make films. I work with old historical documents. My interest in the presidency grew out of my childhood. I had always been interested in the presidency and trying to wrap my head around how someone could be or could hold that office. You know, that's such an intriguing thing for me. Before I worked here, I actually worked at the President McKinley National Birthplace Museum and Library in Niles, Ohio. And so I kind of got my feet wet through that. But like I said, my training is specifically in documentary editing and public and applied history. And so that's what I do here. To refresh you, we came out with an annotated edition of Grant's personal memoirs back in 2017. It was published by Harvard University Press. We added over 2,000 footnotes to his memoirs, so we kind of unpacked everything that he talks about. We identify every single person that he mentions, every place that no longer exists. We clarify him when he's wrong, or when he's vague, and we correct him when he's wrong. And that's actually been a pretty big success. You can find that book on Amazon or through Harvard Press's website.
And what's the title of the book again?
Yeah, so it's The Personal Memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant, The Complete Annotated Edition. And so the lead editor was my boss, Civil War historian John F. Marzlak, who's a great man, and my other co-worker and colleague, David S. Nolan, who's also a very, very sharp, very smart guy. Without those two, that project wouldn't be what it is. I was just there just to help them, but they're really the driving force behind that project. But because of the success of Grant, of that edition of Grant's memoirs, Harvard actually asked us to do Sherman's next. And so that's what we're currently working on, an annotated edition of Sherman's personal memoirs, which hopefully won't take as long, but that book is just as long as Grant's memoirs, so it might take that long. So that's the major project that we have right now. Also, we have another book coming out on April 15th. It's a short biography of Grant. It's entitled Hold On With a Bulldog Grip, A Short Study of Ulysses S. Grant. Yeah, it's co-authored by John F. Marzlak, David S. Nolan, myself, a man named Frank J. Williams, who was a former former Chief Justice of the Rhode Island Supreme Court. He's also the president of the Ulysses S. Grant Association. And there's an afterword written by Mississippi State University President Mark E. Keenum. And so it's a short little biography. It's only about 130 pages long. It really covers kind of the major themes surrounding Grant. So some of the things that I talked about, it covers his relationship, you know, what he, him and slavery. It covers his the myth about him drink, his drunkenness, his time in the war, his relationship with Lincoln, kind of those big themes. So it's a kind of a thematic analysis of Grant's life. And so that's coming out, and like I said, on April 15th, and you can buy that through Amazon or through the University Presses of Mississippi website.
And how do people get in touch with you, Louis, with questions or anything
else?
Yeah,
of course. So you can find my contact information on our website. I'm always up for, I can talk to you on the phone, or you can send me an email if you have a reference question, and I can help out as much as I possibly can.
And the website again is?
Yeah, so let me pull it up real quick so I don't get it wrong. I always get the name wrong. So the website is usgrantlibrary.org.
usgrantlibrary.org.
.org. And like I said, that's where you can find the digitized version of the volumes of the papers of Ulysses S. Grant. You can find other collections that we have digitized, such as photographs, other things like that. And yeah, it's just a great resource for teachers, for historians, you know, both professional and amateur alike.
I've got a few questions for you.
Yeah.
And we'll see how these peg out. Who would you say was his favorite general during the Civil War?
So his favorite Civil War general? I don't want to speak for him, but from what I've read, I would say Sherman was probably his most vital general. He was closest to Sherman. He trusted Sherman the most, and they really fought together for most of the war. I mean, they were together at Shiloh, and so I would definitely say Sherman.
If you were to ask him today, what would he likely answer as being the turning point of the Civil War? When did it finally turn toward the Union's favor?
I don't think he'd have a single answer. I think he would have multiple answers. I think for him personally, Vicksburg was a key moment, right? Because that's essentially splits up the Confederacy. But capturing Chattanooga was another huge moment, because Chattanooga was kind of the heart of the Confederacy at the time. You have all the supplies and railroads going through Chattanooga. And so capturing those two cities really made it was a turning point for him, at least. Knowing what I know about Grant, I don't think he would have been happy until Robert E. Lee signed that surrender at Appomattox. For him, that was probably the turning point, obviously. But that was just knowing what I've read about him. No, he wouldn't be happy until it was over. That would be my guess.
In all that you have read, can you recall one of the most poignant moments for him in his life? Was there a moment? Was there a defining moment that viewers would say that really reveals his personality? That's something I didn't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they might know about this, but that first night after Shiloh, I think really revealed who he was, not only as a person, but as a general, right? Most men would have tucked their tail and ran after that first night at Shiloh, because it was a debacle. They were caught off guard completely. His lines were pushed back. He lost all kinds of men. But he held true. He knew that persistence would pay off, and he understood that if he led his men correctly, that they would fight for him and for the cause that they were fighting for. So I think that moment where he's sitting underneath that tree after the first night in Shiloh, and it's pouring down rain, and Sherman came and talked to him, I think that was a very big moment for Grant, at least as a when it comes to him as a military man. Now, as a person, you know, just in his personal life, I think a defining moment for him, it's not a good moment, but that time when he was selling firewood on the streets of St. Louis, I think that was a big moment for him as well, because he understood that if he was going to help his family, and if he was going to make a better life for himself, that he needed to do something more. And he didn't give up on it.
We might have discussed this in part one, mm-hmm. but what was Grant's attitude toward the Indians?
Yeah, I think we talked about it pretty extensively. But I can kind of touch on it a little bit if you want again. So Grant's, in my opinion, Grant's view of Native Americans at the time was pretty progressive compared to most people. He saw the natives as people who weren't civilized, but should have the opportunity to be quote unquote civilized, right? Civilized meaning that they should be able to farm, they should be Christian, but the most radically that they should have the right to citizenship, which was a radical idea at the time, right? Now it didn't pan out very well, but just being able to present that idea was, I think, progressive for a man in his time.
And one more question: when you're a general in a civil war, and you're responsible for sending tens of thousands of men to their deaths, that's going to affect you in a big way. How did that affect him through his memoirs? What you've learned about him? Does that sadness, was that a sadness that he carried toward the end of his days? Is that something he ever covered, or was that something he kept?
So I think broadly speaking, Grant had an ability to compartmentalize a lot of things. I think that's why he was able to do what he did during the war and after. Because you can imagine just how much that would weigh on you, right? So I think that kind of moderated the effects, but it most certainly still affected him. And you can see that in his memoirs when he talks about the Battle of Cold Harbor, which was a brutal, brutal battle where thousands of his men died in a short amount of time. And he's still criticized to this day for what he did on that last assault. And he talks about that in his memoirs. He said, "I have always regretted that last assault at Cold. That I have always regretted that the last assault at Cold Harbor was ever made." And so I think the casualty estimate for the Union on June 3rd of that battle was around 6,000 men and about 1,500 for the Confederacy. But yeah, he talks about it in his memoirs, and that's in 1885, 20 years after the fact, and he still regretted it. And so even though he was able to compartmentalize some of those things, as you have to be if you're going to be in that position, it still most certainly got to him.
Well, Louis, thank you so very, very, very much for your contribution today and for sharing the story of U.S. Grant in a way that few people can with your narrative and with your research and with your talent for speaking. You've been wonderful, and we want to thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It's been an honor to be on your podcast, and I look forward to listening to more episodes of yours, and I can't thank you enough.
Louis, thanks a lot, and we'll be in touch. Make sure you get in touch with us when you get that book on Sherman done.
Of course. Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yep, have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.